What Donna didn't tell you that the Tennessee, the name of their workshop was called the Sluts Retreat. So we met at Sluts, which stands for Sober Ladies United Together Spiritually. Woo! Yeah. Yeah. So she met me slutting around in Tennessee. Oh, thanks for the laughter and the eye contact and the joy. And thank you for being here. It reminds me of that first thing we see when we look at the steps. It says the number one, and then it says we. Guess what? We are in first place. All right? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It takes a lot of courage to be here. It takes a lot of courage to be here. It took a lot of courage to come to our first meeting. It takes a lot of courage to keep on coming back. I'd like to just share that there's a woman here from Tennessee who is in her fifth week, and I was feeling kind of alone, and she came up and said hello to me. Angie, I'm so glad that you're here. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Now, all of that was the good news. Now, here's the bad news. My name's Linda, and I'm a member of Al-Anon. Whoa! Ah, do you think I'm not a bit nervous and anxious about being here? Now, Donna sent me this little letter to give me some encouragement. I just want to read a little bit of it for you. It says, we're so excited to be writing you this. I'm so excited to be writing you this letter, thanking you for coming down to speak for us. I wanted to explain what we're asking you to do for us. I'm getting nervous. You will be our lead-off speaker on Friday night. Your topic is learning to rely on women. This is the tricky part. And we have usually found that this talk tends to set the tone of the weekend. And she wrote this letter April 1st. I mean, give me a break. First, I don't think there are too many Al-Anons, but I feel like if you're sitting in this chair by that person, by that person, by that person, I think that qualifies you for my program. I've been an Al-Anon for 10 years. Now, that means that I lived 41 years without a program. Now, for those of you slow at math, that makes me 51. Okay? This is an honest weekend, and we're all here learning to share, and I'm at the age that it's important for me to share my age. Okay? So now I've got this encouraging letter from Donna. I have hugs. The committee was so gracious to invite me here, and they gave me this lovely corsage, which smells so nice. There's nothing like flowers. Nothing like flowers. And here I am up here going to share some things with you. And I am, I have some fear. I have some anxiety. And then I remembered something that Lois Wilson was told. Now, Lois Wilson is the co-founder of Al-Anon. She was married to Bill Wilson through all of the active years and through recovery. She was quite an amazing woman. Tell you a little bit about her. She did this deal without us, okay? Just like Bill and Bob did their deal without us. There had to be a beginning. Now, Bill, as you know, had many, many times tried to stay sober, and he was in Cleveland, I mean in Akron, and up there on business, and he had been doing a good job about it, but he was at his wit's end, as y'all know. Wit's end is also the name of his studio where he used to write. I thought that was interesting. And he called Lois, and he says, I'm in a bad place. And talking to other drunks doesn't seem to help me at all. It doesn't seem to help them. And she said, yes, but it helps you. And that's when he made the effort to find Bob. And so that was the birth of AA. So Lois has always been a favorite person of AA. I know that for a fact because I've seen the first big book that came off the printing presses, and Bill gave her that as a gift with a beautiful, beautiful inscription saying, thank you, and we've traveled this road together. So one time somebody asked Lois, what did she do in the moment of silence before the Serenity Prayer meetings? And her answer changed my life, and it changed the meetings that I go to. And she was asked, what do you do? And she says, well, I invite God to the meeting. So what I would like to ask is for another moment of silence and for you to ask your higher power to come to this meeting with us. Please indulge me on this, okay? Amen. So now, the words you heard before were mine. And now, if my prayer is answered that I have an open heart to be able to speak, and your prayer is possibly answered that you have open ears, then the words that happen now we won't be held responsible for. So take what you like and leave the rest. I do have some anxiety about being an Al-Anon in this group, although it's kind of strange because I've certainly been around alcoholics all my life. I am what you call an adult child of an alcoholic, which all that means is at one time I was a child and now I'm an adult. And my dad drinks, okay? And he chooses to still drink. He's in his 70s, and he says for the rest of his life he's going to drink, play golf, and fish. And I would say probably in that order, okay? Al-Anon believes that this is a family disease, and that means that many times it goes from generation to generation. Sometimes it skips generations. And it also means that it affects family members that don't have the allergy to alcohol. And I feel like I fall into that case. I have truly all the isms, all of the anxiety, fear, that emptiness growing up, all of those things that that I can identify with the things I've heard in AA meetings. In case you're ever wondering, if you grew up in an alcoholic home, there's a wonderful little pamphlet that Alateen puts out, and it says, is someone drinking getting to you? I really recommend the Alateen literature. It helped me to go back and read that literature to know what was happening to me on the day that I didn't pass that math exam, because I could remember that my parents were arguing in the other room. It helped me to know why I always felt like I was left out, always trying to knock on that door to get in, to fit in. So the Alateen literature was a great comfort to me. It helped me go back and, in a healthy way, have some healing and relive some of those things. But this says, Alateen is for young people whose lives have been affected by someone else's drinking. The following 20 questions are to help you decide whether or not Alateen is for you. Number one, do you have a parent, close friend, or relatives whose drinking upsets you? This is number three, are holidays and gatherings spoiled because of drinking? Number four, do you tell lies to cover up for something, for someone else's drinking or what's happening in your home? Do you stay out of the house as much as possible because you hate it there? It says, do you make threats such as, if you don't stop drinking and fighting, I'll run away? Do you always make promises about behavior such as, I'll get better in school, I'll go to church, or I'll keep my room clean in exchange for the drinking and fighting to stop? Do you believe no one could possibly understand how you feel? Are mealtimes frequently delayed because of drinkers? Do you think your problem would be solved if drinking stopped? That's a pretty strong piece of literature to put in front of an Alateen. It's strong literature to put in front of us today. I'm a real fan of all of our literature. The Al-Anon literature was my first sponsor. As I know many of you, your big book is possibly your first sponsor, because that book was there with you at 2 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning. You could take it out and read it. I absolutely love my big book. I use the one that I got when I first got into recovery. It was a gift. And it's the one that's underlined in red that I thought my husband should read. Everything I thought he should read, I went through and I underlined it in red. Those were early, early Al-Anon days. You know, I don't attempt at jokes very often, but this joke was told to me. It's an Al-Anon joke. And And I absolutely love this joke. And it kind of tells my part of the story. It says they did this survey, and they found out that all alcoholics have three personalities or more. And they found out that Al-Anons have one or less. Oh, yeah. What can I say? I've shared a little bit about growing up in an alcoholic home. Now, this was a home that my parents really gave me a lot. I'm an only child. My dad did his drinking at the country club. He did it on an expense account. So it was kind of hard to see that alcohol was a problem because it was so much of a way of life with us. We were kind of living in that fast lane. And if somebody had told me alcohol was a problem, they might as well have told me that macaroni and cheese was a problem. It was so much a part of everyday life. But like many of us, I wanted out of that house, and I couldn't tell you why. All of my needs were being provided for. I always had food. I always had nice clothes to wear. I do know there were times that I didn't want to bring my friends home, that I'd drive up, and we lived in a nice neighborhood, and my mom had put all my dad's clothes on the front porch again, you know. Or there'd be times that I would bring some girlfriends home, and my dad wouldn't be able to pick me out of the lineup. He would think that one of my girlfriends was would be me. And those kind of things hurt. And there were days that sometimes I would go for like a week or two and not speak to my dad because I thought that I could somehow control his drinking. But yet if you had set me down and said, I see, alcohol is a problem in your home, I'd say, no, it isn't. That doesn't have anything to do with it. But I knew I wanted to leave. And this was a long time ago. And the only way I knew to leave then was to get married. Yeah, get married. And I thought I was quite an adult. I'd just turned 20. I had known this man for 10 days. Boy, was he exciting, though. My parents thought we should wait a while, and they thought also that he should have a job, and we just kind of thought that was details. So I married, and I had never seen this man drink. And again, even if I had, I wouldn't have thought that that was a problem. But to celebrate our first 2 weeks of marriage, he brought alcohol into our home for the first time. He also brought his best friend, Cliff. So now we've got Cliff to help us celebrate our anniversary of 2 weeks and the beer. And so what happened, maybe some of you can relate to this. He had a little too much to drink. I got a little upset, and I did the only thing I knew. I decided to sleep in the bathtub. We had a very tiny apartment. And I decided that bed wasn't large enough for both of us that night. So that began a pattern. What's the pattern? Oh, let's use sex to try to control the drinking. Yep. I've used it to vamp, to flirt. I've used it to deny, to punish. Guilty as charged, okay? But again, I couldn't see that this was a pattern. I just saw that this was a man that I had married and that we were going to live happily ever after. Is that not the first lie that we believe? That we're going to live happily ever after. Now, I am extremely attracted to this type of personality. several years ago when they had the International out in San Diego, I was invited to be on a panel out there. And the name of the panel was Living with Sobriety After the Honeymoon's Over. I thought that was a funny title. And I thought the only reason I qualified is because I've been married three times, which equals three honeymoons. But sharing the panel with me was a wonderful Al-Anon woman from Georgia. And I don't remember too much about what I said. I don't remember too much about what she said, with the exception of her opening statement. And it's one you may have heard before. And she says, "Hello, my name is so-and-so, and I'm from Georgia, and I'm addicted to mood-altering men." Is that not the truth, you know? And I seem to take it a step further. I was also addicted to altering men's moods. I mean, you know, if it was happy, let's talk about the bills. If he was unhappy, let's talk about all the things I hadn't done, such as, you know, clean that last corner one more time. But I am so attracted to this personality type. I've been considering having some little business cards printed up. And the card would say something to just be helpful. And when I would be at the grocery store, at the dry cleaners, and I would see somebody that I was attracted to, I would hand them this little card, and it would say, "Hello, my name's Linda. I'm a member of Al-Anon. I find you attractive. I suggest you go to the nearest treatment center and have an assessment done." Ah, why not? I told that story at a high school not too long ago in a class of high school kids, and I didn't think they were really listening, and all of a sudden this hand shot up at the back, and I said, "Yes," and this guy says, "Yeah, and you could stand over there by where they sell the beer." He was really cute too, so. Oh, so here I am with this wonderful behavior beginning to happen in me. I begin to be addicted to that addictive type. And this first marriage, we ended up having 2 children and 16 years and 13 geographic cures, in a nutshell. You know, one thing I've discovered or kind of observed that when men tell their story, they kind of tell it by what jobs they have. When women tell their story, we kind of tell it by what relationships we've had. I don't know why that is. So in this first marriage, this gentleman that was, he's very great personality, the one that didn't have a job, decided he was going to be a songwriter. And so that's how I eventually got to Nashville. He was very good songwriter, had a great voice, and he began to work as his job in the different saloons. This is back in Texas. And this is before they had liquor by the drink. And in the Holiday Inns and Ramadas and Sheridans, you had a lounge act. And so he became, his job was to go down there and sing in the lounge. Well, we went on the road, and we actually lived in Holiday Inns with a 2-year-old for like several years. And so this man is getting up and going to work every night. And I decided that was too long of a leash, you know. So I came to him one day and I said, "I would like to play drums in the band." You can't say that we're not determined people. And he says, "Well, have you ever played the drums before?" And I said, "Well, no, but that doesn't matter." And so the bass player took me to a pawn shop. We bought a trap set of drums on Saturday afternoon. Monday night, I'm playing drums in the band. That is the truth. It's pretty amazing. And I did that until I was pregnant with our second child. There's 8 years difference between our 2 daughters. And one night I sat down behind and my tummy sent the snare drum sailing across the dance floor, and I decided it was time to retire. But that was an interesting life. I did a lot of bonding drinking. Do you know what that is? That is that I really believe that if I could drink and party with him, then our life would be happier. What happens in the band, a lot of times they'll send, customers will send drinks up to the band. So each night before we'd go to work, he would tell me what he was going to drink that night so I could go ahead and order it so he could get, you know, 2 for 1. Interesting things happen about when you're up there observing. I think that I have partied right along with everyone. I have seen all of us come in on Wednesday night with the girlfriends and Friday night with the wife. I mean, I have observed a lot of life from up there on stage with the drums. That was kind of a real edgy time in my life. And once we got to Nashville, I thought that was the end of the moves. Like I say, we'd been married 16 years and we had 2 daughters. And we had moved 13 times, not even counting the times that we had been on the road. And I thought, oh, poor pitiful me. Until I read the story of Lois and Bill. They had 68 different mailing addresses until they settled in Stepping Stones in Bedford, New York. These people were on a search. You know, I always thought with every move we were moving towards something. I really believed that. And now what I know through recovery is that we were always moving away from something. And you know what it's like to move? You have to repay the deposits on the gas, the water, the phone bill. Pretty hard to get ahead. So once we got to Nashville, I thought, that's the end of the moves. We're through. And he was very successful in Nashville for a short time. But as you know, alcoholism is a progressive disease. And he just couldn't seem to be clear-headed enough when he was going into the studio, or the pressure of being in the music business was too much. And so he decided to move back to Nashville, and I decided to stay. So now I'm a single mom with two girls, and I do what happens many, many times. I went out and became the breadwinner, and I was expecting my 11-year-old daughter to become the mother. And she was in charge of the 3-year-old, 4-year-old left at home. And this seemed to work for a while. I became a workaholic, which the good news, you know, society kind of says yay to workaholics, and you do get the reward of making money. And so this seemed like a pretty nice-knit family group, except it wasn't a real family, so I thought, well, I'd go ahead and get married again. But this time I'll be more clever. I'll marry a businessman. Yeah, right. He was also my boss, and when he started asking me out, he was also married. But, you know, details. So we married, and it seemed like a Cinderella story. This man was an alcoholic and a cocaine addict. So I am pre-Al-Anon is a progressive disease also. and I believe with all my heart that although I was this man's fourth wife, I knew I was just what he needed. I just knew that's just what he needed. Now, that was a happy marriage for about the first month when we had our first big fight. And wanting to do it differently, we went into counseling. And so we went in front of this counselor, Dr. G, I will call him. And we would go there, and I would cry, and my husband would shut down, and the doctor would open up a paper clip and twirl it. And then he'd say, that'll be $75, and I'll see you next time you have a fight. And we'd go away. And sure enough, we would have a fight, and the last fight was a biggie. We were down in Miami. We were down in the Lower Keys, and we had a fight, and he became very abusive in a restaurant. And I up and announced that I was going home. They thought I was going back to the hotel. I meant I was going back to Nashville. I did just like in the movies. I called a cab. I'm 120 miles away from the airport. I say, please take me to the airport. He says, okay, but we got to go get another cab. We go to a residential area. And his wife met me at the door, and she says, it looks like you're having a hard time. Can I help you with anything? And I said, well, I'm going back to Nashville, and there's snow on the ground. I have on sandals. Would you give me a pair of socks? This was the beginning of the angels in my life. She gave me a pair of socks. And then he took this cab driver, her husband, took me to the Miami airport. And I'd been very sophisticated with travel. I'd got a lot of places with work and for pleasure. And I thought, if I can just get to Miami, I'll get a plane back. And by this time, it's close to midnight. And there were no other flights leaving for Nashville. I thought, great, I'll just get a hotel room. Well, Miami was in the middle of a boat show and some kind of automobile event, and there was literally no rooms to be had. And I ended up spending the night at the Miami airport, and it wasn't especially a safe place. I said a prayer that I didn't even know to a God that I didn't really have a close connect with at that time, and I said, God, my life is unmanageable. And I used those very words, and I'd never seen them before. So I do get back to Nashville. My husband comes in. He's pretty angry. He's never had a woman walk out on him before, you know. And he says, what do we do? And I said, well, let's go see Dr. We said his name, Dr. G. I think he's in the Atlanta area now, so I'm trying to protect his anonymity. So we go in front of Dr. G, and I'm expecting to cry, and I'm expecting my husband to shut down, and I'm expecting Dr. G to twiddle a paperclip. But we walk in, and his eyes are sparkly. And he says, come in, sit down. What had happened? This man from our last visit had gotten in recovery. He was an alcoholic, and he was now in the process of making amends to all of his patients. It was a gotcha. So he sent us up to this a weekend retreat for couples up in South Dakota. And I walked in, and there were 12 steps and 12 traditions on the wall, And I saw that first step, and it used that word unmanageable. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. And then they kind of got together in groups, and they all said the Serenity Prayer. I had never heard the Serenity Prayer. And so this was to help the coupleship. But they kept taking my husband off to the other room. What I know now is that they were trying to do an intervention on his behavior, on his drug addiction and his alcoholism. And I kept stomping my foot like, how can we work on this marriage if they keep him in the other room? What I know now is that they were working on saving his life. So the director of that treatment center, was also the first director of the Betty Ford Foundation. And when we were getting on the shuttle to go back to the airport, this man gave me a hug, and he said one thing to me. He said, get yourself to Al-Anon. I didn't really know what that was, but we got back, and things still weren't very rosy at the home front. So one day I got out the phone book, and I looked up Al-Anon, and it was a meeting really close to my office, which I thought that was quite convenient because I'm still in this, you know, fast-paced, forward business, let's go, and it was a luncheon meeting. It's the Monday downtown midday meeting. And that's the group. They gave me this safety pin to bring. This is what we do. When somebody's getting ready to go do something very difficult, like, you know, talk to parents or speak someplace, we take a safety pin and pass it around and hold it. So this is their way of saying hello to each of you and to keep me safe. So I go, this isn't the Methodist Publishing House, which has a lot of security. And I go and I push the button, and again I'm in my business mode, and they said, this voice said, can I help you? And I said, yes, I am here for an Al-Anon meeting. And I hear pages shuffle, and this voice comes back and says, we don't have any Mr. Anons that work here. He thought I was there to see Al. But somehow they did hear me knocking on that door, and I did walk through that threshold of Al-Anon. It's a loving group, and that happened about 10 years ago. So what happened to me after I got into recovery? That second marriage didn't last. I really believe that Al-Anon was about saving relationships. It isn't. It's about saving lives. This is what recovery does. It saves lives. And so out of the first marriage, I had two wonderful daughters, and out of the second marriage, I got recovery. So here I am, single again, and beginning to have a life, thanks to recovery. I already told you about that number one wheeze. Being an only child and feeling pretty isolated most of the time, I never had that feeling. I never felt like I belonged. And then when I got into Al-Anon, it was the beginning of feeling that I belonged. I had some anxieties I've already shared with you about coming down here, and you've already made me feel so very, very welcome, because I know that we do speak the language of the heart. Things happen to us. This disease crosses economic barriers, political barriers, but guess what? So can recovery. You know, so can recovery. I've already shared that I'm an adult child of an alcoholic. My dad's still active. I'm now in my third marriage to a recovering alcoholic, and we have a relationship of joy, beauty, love, and laughter. It's really incredible. He's an incredible man. And I feel very blessed, and we're both in awe. We're both in awe that a relationship could have inside it the freedom to stay and the freedom to go, which is what my definition is. I'm not held hostage in this relationship, and neither am I holding him hostage. We are both there because we choose to be. That's pretty incredible, and I give recovery all of that, the credit for that. So here I am in a third marriage, and I am doing my Al-Anon thing. Al-Anon saved my life, literally. There was an incident with husband number two that involved a gun. And I was in a struggle with this man with the gun, and Al-Anon's voice said in my ear, I heard them very clearly, they said, detach, detach, which I let go of his arm like it was hot and backed across the room. And so I know that it literally saved my life. If I had continued to do it my way and to struggle, I probably wouldn't be here speaking to you tonight. So I know it did save my life. and it changed my life. I begin to see the good. I begin to have eye contact. I begin to hear the laughter. My home group tells a story on me that one day I stopped at the door and I said, "What's that noise?" And they said, "That's laughter. Come on in," you know. It had been a long time since I'd heard any of it. So what did I find with inside these rooms? I found exactly what the topic says tonight, learning to rely on women. You know, learning to rely on women. Now, that was not an easy task. I always was, I did not have a lot of women in my life. I told you that I was an only child. I didn't have aunts around. My grandmothers lived far away. Until my daughters came into my life, it was a very small tribe of women, you know. So how did I learn to rely on women? By going through these steps. But the first thing I had to do was learn to rely on this thing that we call a higher power. And I believe that before I got into Al-Anon, this higher power was could be best described as maybe a referee in some kind of sports event. I'd be going along doing life, a whistle would blow, and I'd be penalized. And I wouldn't know exactly why, but I would know that I had done something wrong and that I had been penalized. But miracles kept happening in my life. Even though there was this strange God out there blowing this whistle, this referee God blowing this whistle, miracles would happen, like the births of my two daughters. So it was a very confusing God of my understanding that I brought into Al-Anon. I did say that prayer in the Miami airport that I believe with all my heart was an answered prayer, because my life was totally unmanageable. But the first three steps are what gave me a loving, gentle God, the God of my understanding today. Now, I work with a lot of women. When we start going through the steps, we talk about the God of your understanding. Because I said, I'm going to send you to that God a lot, to spend time with that God. And if it isn't a gentle, loving God, I don't want to send you to a place that's unsafe. So we do a lot of talking about what this God is like. Now, whenever you get into conversations like that, you know, you get into that age-old argument, well, is God a man or is God a woman or whatever? Well, I have a very loving friend that helped me out on this. She is the mother of five children. And one day she said, I can say for sure that God is not a woman. Really? She says, yes, if God had been a woman, we would have had immaculate delivery. But my God today is all the wonderful femininity, all the nurturing things. My God has no limit today. It's not for me to limit the God of my understanding, because I keep growing in that. One of the women I sponsor was having a lot of trouble with one of her sons one day. This is a very, very neat woman. She's very loving. And she probably helped me more with this first step, with this little story, than any other time. The little brother was bugging the big brother. And he was in the big brother's room and in the big brother's space and in the big brother's stuff. And so she took him aside, the big brother's side, and says, now, Ian, you know that we are powerless over people, places, and things. And Ian said, nouns? Oh, is that not the truth? We are powerless over nouns and adjectives and adverbs, you know? But for me, this loving God that I have, which is sometimes the sunset, which is sometimes the smell of the ground when it rains, which is sometimes even that threshold of pain when something takes my hand and helps me through that, the God of my understanding is my sponsor picking up the phone when it rings. It's what we hear in meetings. It's this gathering that we have right now. It's this energy of love and caring. And sometimes I forget that, but that is the love of my understanding that I'm turning my life over to today. And the reason I forget that is because I get busy. I get busy doing this stuff called life, like going to here and coming there and doing this and doing that. And there was a bumper sticker that helped me with that a lot. It was for a dog obedience school. And like in really tiny letters, it said, Jones Dog Obedience School. And in larger letters, it said, Sit Happens. So when I remember that bumper sticker, I can remember that I do have a gentle, loving God. The other thing that reminds me of this gentle, loving God that's available to me, because I always thought that this God was only going to be available to me when I kind of spiffied myself up. You know, if once I, first of all, I thought that I had done too much for this God to want to spend any time with me, or that I was unworthy, or that there had to be something that I could do to, you know, kind of increase God's love for me. And what I know now that is God just loves me. And the second thing I know about the God of my understanding is that there's no limit to how happy this God wants me to be. I used to think that I could only have so much of the good stuff, and then it was going to all run out, and that would be the end of that. But I believe with all my heart that there's no limit to how happy God wants us to be. And I think weekends like this prove that over and over again. But there was a commercial on TV about V8 juice. Remember, you saw the people running around, rushing here, rushing there, and then they admit or forget that they haven't had lunch, and they go, oh, I could have had a V8. Oh, this is what I do. I get to rushing around, and I go, oh, I could have had an HP. And why not? It's available. So if you see me some days and this is kind of red, you know I need a lot of prayer support on that. So how did I learn to rely on women? I had to first learn that I could rely on a God, a gentle God of my understanding. I had to know that I was worthy of recovery. I had to know that I was worthy of time and sharing. And the next thing I had to do is to realize that I had to be reliable myself. Now, that does not mean rely on myself. I had isolated, I had white-knuckled things for a long time. I was really good at keeping those secrets. When I got into recovery, I was living in a mansion. It had 6 bathrooms, and everybody thought that it was the Cinderella story. But I'm here to tell you, as you well know, no one knows what goes on behind those closed doors. We were always the looking good, feeling bad family. There was abuse. There was all kinds of misconduct. And yet, on the outside, it looked like I should have been really, really happy. And that was a confusing thing. That was a confusing thing. So how did I know how to rely on myself? How did I discover that I was reliable? By working the 12 steps. By taking that fearless and searching moral inventory. I have listened to a lot of 5th steps. I've done the best 5th step I've ever done was we were at an assembly, an Al-Anon assembly. That's like the gathering. I don't know what the AA's called. It's called an assembly. And we were down in Murfreesboro, and this woman didn't have a room that evening, and so I asked her to come, you know, how we do. She said, you know, come bunk with me. So we're upstairs, and we're sharing our story. Now, this is an Al-Anon function. And so we're getting very, you know, chit-chatty, and she says, have you ever gone through the steps by using the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? Well, I immediately looked around for the Al-Anon police because the big book is not conference-approved literature. But this woman was a very strong Al-Anon person. And so she took me through the steps by using the big book, and it literally changed my life. I'd been in Al-Anon about 4 years when that happened, and it literally changed my life. That the 4-step guide is incredible. My first sponsor... Because what the 4-step guide did was it showed me the reality of what I had done, the reality of what I'd lived through. And the big book says something about the great reality. And isn't that the truth? If I can speak my truth and you can speak your truth, then that eliminates all the confusion, all of the controlling, all the manipulation, that we can have a clean exchange. So that 4th and 5th step really cleaned up my act. And
You know, I'm not going to go into my fifth step, but I can tell you that I've been involved with a married man. You know, everything I have heard in a fifth step from an Al-Anon is shared stories. We were women out there trying to survive and surviving. That's the neat part about it. We are. We're survivors. So what this did for me was it cleaned it up. I didn't have to look down at the ground all the time. I didn't have to try to keep the secrets. I didn't have to remember what I told you when I talked to you the next time around. It literally cleaned it up and gave me the freedom to live a life. And I did find out that I am reliable, that I am very reliable on being able to share. I'm very reliable on being able to pray together with another woman. Those steps did for me. I now have a God of my understanding that I can rely on. I now have an inner peace that I can rely on. You know, this intuition had always been down there, but because of the misconduct, the dysfunction, the new buzzword maybe, because of all of those things, I had forgotten to listen to that voice, that wonderful, wonderful voice of our strength and our power. So now I found out that I am a reliable person. So now it's time for me to learn how to rely on women. My first sponsor was great because she told me the truth. She told me the truth. I'd say for the most part, always in a loving way. When I was going through that second divorce, I came home one time and the house was dark and the kids were gone, the dog was at the kennels, and I called her crying, and I said, I just feel so rejected. And she says, you have been. I picked the phone out and looked at it. I'm thinking, okay, but anytime you can tell me the truth, I can deal with that. That's what I've discovered. I can deal with that because I have a place to go to be nurtured and loved. So learning to rely on women. My definition of learning to rely on women, I was in the commercial real estate business for a long time. In most of the meetings, I'd be the only female in the room. It was a very hard-paced, nothing soft about that industry when I first got into it. So I thought that the women that I knew were either after my husband, after my job, after something that I thought was all mine to claim. So I didn't have any trust. This was what was missing in my life before I got into program. The ship of trust had been totally blown out. But growing up in an alcoholic home, we learned not to trust. It's not safe to trust. It's not safe to believe that they're really going to be there on your birthday. It's not safe to believe that that you're going to be okay and you're going to get a good night's sleep. So I had learned that it wasn't safe to trust. So through these rooms and talking to other women, I have learned that it is okay to trust because I became trustworthy. And people saw that in me, and then they allowed themselves to be vulnerable enough and to become trustworthy. So how do we know when we have these clean exchanges with each other? It's pretty easy to, even in sponsor and sponsoree relationships, to get too involved in other people's lives, because this is what we do. Even though it's in the idea of caring, Al-Anon main core belief is that I'm supposed to keep the focus on myself. And I know this seems like a conflict. This does not mean that I'm supposed to be selfish and just bull my way through life. It means that I'm supposed to take care of myself first, my recovery, and then once I get healthy enough, then that will be shown to the other people in my life. That doesn't mean that I'm not available when somebody else needs me. But even if one of the women calls me and they say, is this a good time to talk? I have the right to say, no, this isn't a good time to talk if I'm not in a strong place. And what I believe that their part of their recovery is to dial that second phone number or that third phone number, because we are all there to be available for each other. But how do we know when we're having a clean exchange? This is really true about relationships. Living with this wonderful recovering alcoholic, I still have a tendency to want to kind of get into his life in inappropriate places. He has an office at home, and he recently hired a new secretary. And it's not in our house. It's in a, but it's on the grounds. It, there's an upstairs. We converted all of the upstairs. It has its own entrance to offices. And so the secretary comes and works up there, and he travels a lot. And so I was thinking the other day, you know, she's up there by herself. I bet she would really like to have a radio. And I should go take her radio. And then it dawned on me, that's none of my business. You know, maybe he doesn't want a radio in the background when a business customer calls in. So I would took this to my meeting, and I said, you know, how do we know when we're being helpful? How do we know when we're, you know, stepping into somebody else's territory? And we came up with three wonderful questions. If you ask yourself, chances are if these are in place, then you're having a good exchange with another human being. The first question is, did the person ask for help? Pretty obvious one. Sometimes we step in there whether or not that's ever asked or not. The second question is there a time limit on how much help they want us to give? And the third one is there a thank you after the exchange is over? So if those three things are in place, it's a pretty healthy, you know, interchange with another human being. Pretty swell questions. Did they ask for help? Is there a time limit on it? You know, we're not going to take anybody on to raise for life, right? I've already put two girls through college. I'm not willing to do that again. Okay, did they ask for help? Is there a time limit on it? And did they say thank you when it's over? That thank you is pretty important. If you tell me thank you, that means that I was invited into your space. Okay? I'd like to talk a little bit about prayer and meditation. These are things that I've learned from other women in program, things that I share with the women that I sponsor in program. Now, the prayer part gets pretty tricky. What I know for sure is that why is not a prayer. And boy, did it take me a long time to learn that. Why is not a prayer. And worry is not a meditation, although it does have a lot of that same thing about meditation in it. So I would say of all of the prayers that I have discovered through program is one that I use in the bedroom. Okay? This is the X-rated part of my talk, and I will get through this. We don't walk through these rooms without being abused and used. I told you that I slept in the bathtub the first time that my husband and I had a fight. I am also an incest survivor, and I've done a lot of work, and I'm not here to carry on about that. But when I got into this third marriage with this recovering alcoholic, I wanted the bedroom to be a healthy place also, and as it should be, because we are human beings, and this is what I believe a wonderful gift that God has given us, this physical exchange. But I had a lot of anxiety, because every time I would walk into their bedroom, there would be ghosts. There would be lots of ghosts, and there would be lots of fears and a lot of, oh no, here we go again type feelings. So I came up with a prayer that I use, and I share it with you tonight. And the prayer is simply this: God, help me stay in the moment. That's all I'm asking. God, help me stay in the moment. That takes away all of those bad experiences that happened to me before I made an agreement with this particular person to enter into an adult physical exchange. So if I say God, help me stay in the moment, it takes away all that history. And it also takes away the fear of how's he going to feel in the morning? Is it going to be good enough? Am I going to do the right thing? My prayer is, God, let me stay in the moment. And it's pretty incredible that Mother Nature takes care of the rest. If anybody could have told me that I would be this feisty in the bedroom at this age with my history. It's also the freedom of being the only two people in the house, too. My girls are gone. So now we have this thing of meditation, which I dearly love. Now, meditation, and again, this is the thing that I've learned through relying on women and exchanging. You tell me how you share your meditation, I tell you how I share mine. And out of that grows the whole understanding of meditation. I used to be real timid about this because I thought you had to be kind of like, you know, in a perfect place and had to have the mood lights and the mood music and you had to really kind of get with it. Well, my daughter helped me on that one time. Well, she said, well, Mom, let's do a meditation. And I said, okay. And she says, hi, God. And that made it so relaxed and so personal. She just said, hi, God. Just, you know, come sit down with us for a little while. So what I know now that my best place to have a meditation is sometimes in the car wash. I love it. I'm there like a cocoon. I love getting into my car, especially this time of year when it's kind of cool outside and you step inside your car and it's all warm by the sun. I call that a God hug. And I just stop for a little while and just absorb it and just enjoy it. So for me, meditation doesn't have to be something long and drawn out. It says thought. It says thought. All we have to do is seek and just try it. There's a meditation that I'd like to just share with you real quickly that came to me that I've been using for several months now. And this seems very, very appropriate for me to real quickly just tell you about this. However you do get into your relaxing state, if you just visualize some kind of vessel above your head, and it can be any kind of vessel. It can be jeweled. It can be just a plain pot like you would garden with. It can be any kind of wonderful container that you want. And you start putting in that your sponsor, the last time you laughed, the smell of a little puppy, the sunshine on your face. You put in all these good things, and it kind of starts swirling around. And then very slowly, the vessel empties. And like wonderful wax melting across you, it just slowly seeps down and closes you in these wonderful good things that you have filled your vessel with. I think that your vessel is going to be very full this weekend. So when you do this meditation, just let that wonderful love slowly, slowly melt down over you from head to toe. And then just like a lotion, it'll get absorbed into your skin and it will become a part of you. And that's good. That's really good. So there's some wonderful places to do some meditations out here, walking with beside the lake or looking at that moon tonight. I hope that you have a weekend of some meditation. I guess if I had to say that recovery gifts have been many, too many to name. We heard some of them today, the Ninth Step Promises. Those are such incredible gifts. I absolutely love them. I'd like to read just a little bit out of this. Al-Anon has an ODAT book called One Day at a Time. There's readings every day of the year. When you get a hold of one of these books, I suggest you read your birthday. That's always fun. But this is from January the 12th and January the 13th, and I believe this is some Al-Anon promises. It says, I have a right to live. I have a right to free myself from any situation that interferes with my having a decent life and pleasant experience. Every human being is entitled to live without fear, uncertainty, discomfort. That's a grand promise. It is time I learned to enjoy the thousands of little things that occur in my daily life. A sunrise, the sound of birds, a long walk, noting all the interesting things I see, a piece of music, a good book, a charming response from a child, a moving story at an AA meeting, a small household chore perfectly performed, a beautiful meal created by me. Those are wonderful promises that Al-Anon has offered for me. This book became my best friend. One time it ran away from home, and it was gone for like several days. I was quite upset because, as you know, with your first AA book, it had people's phone numbers in it. I'd underlined. I mean, this had my soul. And I finally decided to use one of the slogans to let go and let God. And that Monday was going to be my meeting, and I was just going to go buy a new book. What a concept. But I was sad. I was very sad that I had lost this book. Well, that Monday night, that Sunday night, after I'd made that decision, the telephone rang, and this guy says, have you lost a little Bible?
And I said, yes. And he says, you know, I like to never found you. It had a lot of first name and telephone numbers in it. And this wonderful man kept calling all these people till they put together. And he was out on the interstate. He said his car broke down, his pickup truck broke down, and he opened up the hood and he looked down there, and right at his feet was my ODAP book. And what had happened, I'd been going to a meeting and I padded up on top of the car. So he said, I'll bring it back to you. So we agreed to meet at the convenience store. This man got out of his pickup truck. He looked like Hoss Cartwright. He was huge, huge. And I said, I'm going to give you a hug. And he said, oh, shucks. So my wonderful ODAP friend came back home. So we have many, many gifts. Many, 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 many gifts in recovery. And this is a room full of gifts in recovery. And this weekend is a gift. But if I had to say one thing that was the gift of my recovery, that was the spiritual awakening that I had at the end of the 12 steps, and that is that I have choices. I never believed I had choices before. I never believed I had choices before. I always thought that I had to react to everything around me. I always thought I had to react. And there's a wonderful story about a village. This is a once upon a time story, so bear with me. So once upon a time, there was a village, and there was a wise, wise, wise old man in this village. And people loved him. They came from miles around to talk to him and to share their stories with him. And there was a young boy in the village. I guess in this day and age, we would say he had an attitude. And he was always trying to trip up this old man. And he finally came up with a great scheme. And the scheme was he was going to catch a baby bird. And he was going to go to the old man, and he was going to hold the bird behind his back. And he was going to ask the old man whether the bird was dead or alive. So the scheme was this. If the wise old man said the bird was alive, the boy was going to crush it and simply show him the dead bird. And if the wise old man said, well, the bird's dead, of course the young boy would then show him the live bird. It was a good scheme. So they invited all of the village people to come, and the wise old man was there, and the young boy caught the bird, and he held it behind his back, and he went to the wise old man, and he says, if you're so wise and all-knowing, you tell me whether or not this bird is dead or alive. And the wise old man looked at him, and he said, the choice is yours. So the choice is ours. Whether or not when we get our registration in the mail, we fill it out and send it back. The choice is ours whether or not we choose to go to a meeting. The choice is ours whether or not we call a sponsor. And the choice is ours if we want to say no to something that we choose not to participate in. That is the story of my recovery. Pretty incredible. Al-Anon's emblem, whatever, symbol is worry. We just worry. We just worry a lot. We just worry about things and people. Oh, yes, you know them all. We just worry. And I finally got healthy enough to realize that I couldn't continue to worry. But I couldn't give it up. I mean, it was just my favorite sport, my favorite pastime. So then I had to come up with something that I could worry about that would be healthy. So I'm going to give you something to worry about. In case your list is too short. Now, this is serious. I got to wondering one day what would happen if everybody and all of the animals, I'm talking the cats and the dogs, sneezed at the same time. Now, this is very serious. I mean, you think about it. When everybody goes, we'd probably eliminate the ozone layer. Really? And when everybody went, achoo, it'd probably just shake the whole earth off of gravity. I mean, this is a serious thing to worry about. So what would happen if everybody sneezed at the same time? Let's try it. Okay, we could try that. But I worried about this long enough until I came up with the answer. If we all sneezed at the same time, I don't know what would happen to the ozone layer. I don't know what would happen to gravity. But I believe with all my heart a wonderful, loving voice would say, God bless you. Thanks for letting me be here. Yeah.